Hi, everyone, and welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Sophia Simonello.
And I'm Nick Rohrkraut.
And today we're going back in time to visit the career of one of the greatest directors of all time, definitely in Oscar history. We will be talking about John Ford. Previously, we covered the careers of William Wyler and Frank Capra, because they had records. They had won multiple Best Director Oscars, but John Ford really is the king of the category. He had 4 wins in Best Director. We've already talked about one of those wins, How Green Was My Valley, on an Oscar Rewind, so we won't be covering that one today, but we will be talking about the other 3, The Informer, The Grapes of Wrath, and The Quiet Man. And we'll also be getting into some history of Ford along the way and talking about why we think these movies were his Best Director wins.
I think off the bat, you know, when you list those names before covering the Oscars and going through the history of who John Ford is, I would not have expected those 3 to be the ones that he was awarded for.
Mm-hmm.
How I know John Ford is from film class, probably like many others, that we watch Stagecoach and dissected that movie and how instrumental that movie is to many recent directors. So for him not being awarded for that film or many others that he made over 100 movies in his career, and also with many different studios back in the day. So he's just such a prolific film director that many, again, nowadays, considering Kurosawa or Scorsese or Orson Welles, looked up to and really based their films on. So I think it is important that we cover John Ford. I know maybe many of these movies are in the early days of cinema, and many of the movies that he made, like silent films, aren't around anymore. They were just destroyed and never recovered. So that's upsetting. But at least the movies we'll be talking about today and many of his later career, people can enjoy. And I'm excited to talk about these. Like you said, we also talked about How Green Was My Valley. And I was also a fan of that. And I kind of wasn't expecting to like it at the time. And I think I feel similarly about some of these movies as well. So we'll get into everything. What is your relationship to John Ford and his films?
Yeah, it's interesting because it really is what you alluded to, which is that these films are not the films that I think of when I typically think of John Ford, with the exception of one of them, which I love, that we'll get to. But yeah, I think of him as a director of Westerns. I think of Stagecoach. I think of The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. I think of The Searchers. Those are the movies that I associate with John Ford. And I think those are the movies that those directors that you were talking about also associate with John Ford. And it's funny too, because the big director I think of, the big modern director that I think of when I think of Ford, is Steven Spielberg. And that was, I think, further amplified when we saw The Fabelmans and David Lynch makes that cameo as Ford. And of course, when I was doing these watches for this episode, I was paying attention to where the horizon line was in all of those. And he does not put it in the center. It's interesting. It is a thing that he sticks with in his vistas that he shoots. That horizon line, he switches it up, which I love that Spielberg included that detail in The Fabelmans. But I am a huge lover of classic cinema, but I would never list John Ford as one of my directors. And I was trying to think of why that is, because he obviously is so inspirational, like you said, to so many filmmakers. He's made a number of great films. He's really stood above the rest of the pack when it comes to Oscar history. But it's really, I've realized, because of my obsession with The Leading Lady. My entry point to classic film was through lead actresses. It was loving Ingrid Bergman and Audrey Hepburn and Deborah Carr, and thinking about, you know, these women at the center of these films, Joan Crawford, Betty Davis. They're not here in his films. A lot of his films are very much focused on these really bleak stories about the American man in particular. Now, there are women in his films. It's not that, but he doesn't make the types of films that were my gateway and my entry point into classic cinema. So I think I actually came to him a bit later, mostly through film classes, sort of like you. So I don't have the same sort of special relationship with him that I do with directors like William Wyler, for instance. So it'll be interesting to talk about today because I wonder if we actually have a similar sort of relationship with him. I think mine is mostly one of, you know, respect and admiration, but not so much of I deeply connect with these films and feel the need to put them on my best of lists and talk about them all the time.
Well, I have two things that are really interesting. One is that, you know, all of these great directors, even Alfred Hitchcock, they all loved him. And then Quentin Tarantino comes and he despises him. He hates him for what he does in his movies of upholding these white Anglo-Saxon ideals and showing the suffering of Native Americans or women in his movies. And I think a big one is in The Quiet Man that we'll talk about last, and Maureen O'Hara's character there and what she has to do or how she has to stick up for herself. But the other thing is, I think there are a lot of similarities and differences between him and Wyler. And I think some of why I like both of them are for the same and different reasons. They love their extras. They love their actors and just setting the frame to look magnificent. And John Ford does that incredibly well with Technicolor. And I think William Wyler's frames are also very detailed and they both kind of creep up on you. I feel similarly about John Ford, and you know, he's not in my top five directors, but I think his movies creep up on you. And by the end, you feel the melancholy or the sentimentality of his human connections and really what he's getting at in the movie. So I think at first glance, they're difficult for me, but once I get through them, I can really appreciate them and see what he's trying to say. And that goes for other movies that we won't talk about today that he's made that we can mention later on of what we think he should have been nominated for, or maybe our favorites that we're not talking about. So again, there are plenty of John Ford movies. If none of these sound like something you would enjoy, check out something else.
So a little bit of background. John Ford was born on February 1st, 1894. He's an Aquarius in Cape Elizabeth, Maine, to Irish immigrant parents. The Irish struggle and the immigrant struggle will come up throughout his films, especially the ones that we talk about today. He was married to Mary McBride Smith in 1920. They had two kids, one of the rare men of the time who only had one wife. Another interesting fact. He won four Best Director Oscars, like we've talked about, for The Informer, The Grapes of Wrath, How Green Was My Valley, and The Quiet Man. And he was also nominated for Best Director for Stagecoach and Best Picture for The Quiet Man as a producer. He also directed two documentaries that won Oscars, The Battle of Midway and December 7th. So just getting into his history a little bit, he moved to LA in 1914. He had an older brother named Francis Ford, not Francis Ford Coppola, but Francis Ford. And he was in Hollywood at the time, already working as a director and as an actor. And he then started working in his brother's movies and just working around Hollywood. He was an assistant director, camera operator, a prop assistant, a stuntman even. He had a number of different roles when he moved to Hollywood. And he also, like you mentioned, directed a number of silent films. So we won't talk about any of those today, but he made around 60 silent films. And most of those are lost to history, which is so sad. There's so many films that he has, feature films and short films from the silent era, that are just completely lost. And you think about the impact he had on other directors. Think of what, you know, how many other filmmakers maybe could have been inspired by those and still could be. And most of his work, again, up to that point, was in the Western genre. So even before he makes the Westerns, I think that we think of and we associate with him, that was the genre that he was tied to. But by the time we get to the 20s, Hollywood starts losing interest in the Western. So after he makes Three Bad Men in 1926, he abandons the Western and he doesn't make another one for 13 years. That Western in 13 years that he makes is 1939's Stagecoach, which turns 85 this year. And this is considered to be one of the most influential movies ever made and actually revitalizes the Western genre. So he wants to get away with it because Hollywood's losing interest. But then 13 years later, he comes and makes this movie and it changes everything. And now the Western is back. It's important, I think, also to think of the war. And there's a really great book called Five Came Back that I recommend everyone read. We talked about this a little bit, I think, on our Wyler episode as well, about our directors who went to war and how that influenced them in coming back. The Hal Green Was My Valley, which we talked about, was the last movie he made before the end of World War II. And then he, like Wyler, looks into documentary filmmaking. I think it's really interesting to think about how directors at that time really considered documentaries as a way to help the war effort. And it wasn't just something that one of them did. It was really, I think, a popular thing for them at the time. And then after he makes The Quiet Man, he ended up having to get surgery. After the surgery, he makes The Searchers, which is considered, I think by many, his best film. We talked about learning about Stagecoach, but I think that The Searchers is the one where when directors are looking at his filmography and they're thinking about what influences and inspires them, The Searchers is the big one. And it even influenced David Lean when he was making Lawrence of Arabia. So if you think about all these movies that came after too, it's like, we wouldn't have Scorsese, we wouldn't have Spielberg, we wouldn't have David Lean and Lawrence of Arabia if not for The Searchers. So major deal. And then he also is the first director to win consecutive Best Director Oscars. And he directed 10 actors in Oscar-nominated performances, and half of them ended up winning.
Yeah, and we'll talk about some of those wins today. But I think looking at the history tells you a lot about his movies, especially the ones we'll talk about today, including his themes of, like you said, the immigrant experience, especially relating to Ireland, him even going back there in his later movies like The Quiet Man, other themes of guilt and identity, but then also techniques that he uses like Wyler. And I liked reading how he edits his movies kind of in his head as he's going. He's not Wyler, who is known as 40 take Wyler. He kind of relies on a very low number of takes, usually only one take, because he believes that the actors will show the best emotion in that one take. And that's what he's really going for, is the emotion that these relationships that his characters hold and share with each other. So I think before we get too far into it, let's just dive right into the movies, starting off with The Informer from 1935. The description here: Gippo Nolan is a former Irish Republican Army man who drowns his sorrows in the bottle. He's desperate to escape his bleak Dublin life and start over in America with his girlfriend. So when British authorities advertise a reward for information about his best friend, current IRA member Frankie, Gippo cooperates. Now Gippo can buy two tickets on a boat bound for the States, but can he escape the overwhelming guilt he feels for betraying his buddy? This stars Victor McLaughlin, Heather Angel, Preston Foster, Margot Graham, and more. So this won 4 Oscars for director, lead actor for McLaughlin, screenplay, and music scoring for Max Steiner. And then it had 2 other nominations for picture and film editing. So how did you feel about this movie? How do you relate it to John Ford's career in the movies that you saw from him?
Yeah, so I think that this is a really great entry point for people who are looking to delve into Ford's early films. It's not one of the silence, but it does, I think, contain a lot of techniques and storytelling tenets that we find in silent film. In fact, the beginning of it, when you're watching it, it feels like a silent film. There's an entirely wordless opening section that I think is really smart in how it's executed. I think that the other really cool thing about this movie is that you can see the ideas that Ford is interested in that bleak life and needing to start over, needing to get out of a place, but not being able to really do so. That I think is all here. And I think here you start to see, oh, he is a master of blocking and composing a shot. The way that the characters are framed is perfect every single time. It does exactly what it needs to do to communicate how the characters are feeling and how dire you should feel about this situation, I think. And there are a couple of shots where I remember thinking, you know, when you're looking at Jippo's internal struggle and you see that communicated visually in really inventive ways through, there are lots of little different dissolves or he'll layer different things to show what he's thinking. That's really smart and not something that I think a lot of filmmakers were doing back in 1935. So he's, I think, really thinking ahead and also focusing on the themes that are going to really persist throughout his entire career.
I agree about a lot of that. I think it's a great movie to start with. It's of the three today, the one I keep thinking about the most, actually, and thinking that I want to return to it. Starting out my first watch, I had a little trouble. It took maybe just two or a few starts to like get me going. But again, once I got into it, I kind of fell into it. And now, weeks later, I'm like, I think I really want to watch that again, because it gets into Jippo's psyche and really how he functions and how he screws himself over. You know, that guilt is so difficult to handle. And Ford can show you that with his camera, which I think is really, really interesting and shows that he's such a master with it. I love his blocking. Mm-hmm. He has a lot of dissolve cuts that work really well in his films. It's kind of an old technique, which some directors are bringing back today, which I love to see. But I think having Victor, you know, who won the Oscar, thankfully, but he was seen as this anti-hero at the time. And I think the way Ford portrays him really flips this movie on its head. It makes you unpack his relationship with his girlfriend, which you meet very early on. And that really sets up the entire movie for this 10 pounds and the 20 pound reward of his friend and how he can make that trip to America happen. But he's kind of trapped inside himself and in this country in Dublin. And the rest of the movie is the result of trying to make that happen. So I think it's a brilliant story, one that I think, you know, at its bones we've seen before. But again, it's the direction that really sets us apart from many others.
I completely agree. And the visual language that Ford uses here is so smart. There are so many metaphors that are created from how he looks at objects on screen. Like, I think of the moment when we see the flyer with Frankie and the reward, and then that flyer crumples up and is stuck to his leg. That is just another thing, right? It's like not being able to escape this, having something weighing on your mind like that. And what choice would you make, right? Are you going to be a Judas and turn in your friend? But also, what's the motivation behind doing that? And how desperate must you be, right, to do that for money so that you can escape to go to America? But then your situation is, again, just so dire that once you have that money, you just completely squander it. Mm-hmm. And I think watching him go through that night where he's just losing all of that money, it's so hard to watch because it's like, okay, you did all of this and now for what?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that, of course, informs that guilt that is pervasive for the character throughout the movie. And I think Ford, he captures that so well in those dissolves. Like, you think of the one where you see Jippo's face and then we see the dissolve of the amount of the reward money. Like, it's weighing on him. Mm-hmm. It's a decision that he has to make. Or we see manifestations of Frankie in the film after he's gone. And that is just, again, it's a visual representation of guilt that's communicated in a way that's separate from the dialogue or the drawing of the character. And when you watch something like that, yeah, it's like, okay, it creeps into your mind in a way that you don't expect. And you think, okay, that is why Ford was the director that everyone looked up to. It's he's doing different new things, taking things from the past, bringing them into the future, but also pushing the boundary on what on paper I think is a really simple story. And like you said, one that we've seen before, but I think what he's doing here is is different, and it sticks with you.
Yeah, and a lot of these techniques that he's using come from German Expressionism. So I think those work so well in this black and white format that he uses, and in establishing an early noir setting for all of these perfect ideals and themes. That breeze in the front, so we talked about the poster and it getting caught on his leg. There's this breeze that brings the poster up into his leg. And it, again, that little bit is just like, it's fate. It's pushing you to address this. And even something as small as that really hooked me in. I loved that so much.
Yeah, it's a great detail that's early. And you're, I think what you said about noir is so right. And what's even cooler about that, I think, is that a lot of these noir techniques from German Expressionism that he's bringing in are due to budgetary constraints, like being really creative, having to shoot with the lighting that they had and the spaces that they had, and really sticking to budget. We've talked about directors who go over budget on their films and go really long. Ford was not that director, especially here. I think he really stuck to it. And that's how we got a lot of those details that make the film work so much more. And I don't know, I think this movie it's really sad too, because I think that you know how it's going to go by as you see it unfold. You know this is not going to be some Cinderella story happy ending where he's able to, you know, make it out. But I think that by the ending, when we do get that forgiveness from Frankie's mother, I think that also ties in again with his themes that you find in the other films around forgiveness and grief and guilt and your own personal struggle with your actions and what you might do to find a new life.
I have two like funny comments about this movie. One is, again, I saw it a while ago, which means there were other movies that were in our headspace at the time. And there's a quote, "He's as rich as Crassus," when he either drops the coins or they find out he has a lot of money. And I was like, oh my God, not Megalopolis again. And my other thing is, you mentioned the Fablemans before, and as they're shooting the door frame and he leaves, you can see a poster of The Informer there. So while his inspiration in the Fablemans and maybe for the film was the man who shot Liberty Valance, it's funny that the last Ford poster you see is The Informer, which really brings it back to the beginning, Valance being later in his filmography.
Oh, I love that. That's such a great detail. Mm-hmm. I haven't watched The Fablemans in a while.
Watching the clip with John Ford, I'm like, I need to do this immediately. I miss this movie.
So getting into our questions, how do you think today's Academy would receive this movie?
I think it would do really well as an indie movie if its release was done right. So the other thing with this movie is that the studio kind of fumbled it. And at first, it wasn't going to be a big release. And they kind of repackaged it. And it was thankfully a success at that point. And it's probably partly because of that that we're talking about this movie today. Kind of scary, you know, had it not been done right, that we wouldn't be, because I think he's deserving of it. But I think as an indie movie, it would do really, really well. I don't see it making a ton of money, but I think considering it had 4 Oscars and 2 other nominations, you know, maybe it could be a late-breaking film that does that well. I kind of don't think so, but it is an interesting story and one that I think could today, in the rare case, like pull off the same feat. What do you think?
Yeah, I was thinking a lot about the themes found in it, like an immigrant story, a little bleak. And of course, I was thinking about The Brutalist, which is a very different movie, obviously, than The Informer. But I think that those sorts of themes, they hit very hard because they're serious. I think you have this feeling that you're watching something really important when you're watching a story like that. But also, another film that was mentioned in comparison to The Informer, Martin Scorsese references The Informer with The Departed, which was a major Oscar hit, also very different, much flashier, but it's also about that idea of Irish guilt, of betraying your friends. And you have to wonder, you know, could The Informer do as well as The Departed, winning Best Picture, winning Best Director, maybe. But yeah, I think it would still, I think people would still respond pretty well to it today.
And then with Ford having one director, would you have given him Best Director this year? We didn't have five nominees. We had three others. One was Michael Curtiz, who directed Captain Blood. This was a write-in vote, which I think is really interesting. I wish we had some of those today. It was not an official nomination. Our other nominees were Henry Hathaway for The Lives of a Bengal Lancer and Frank Lloyd for Mutiny on the Bounty.
So I haven't seen The Lives of a Bengal Lancer, but based on the other films and The Informer, I think John Ford absolutely deserved this Best Director win. I think it's a great win. And if you look at the other films from the year, Broadway Melody of 1936, Alice Adams, David Copperfield, Naughty Marietta. I mean, The Informer, I think, really does stand above the rest of the pack as the film from 1935 to watch. So I think this is absolutely a deserved win. What about you?
So this was the year Mutiny on the Bounty won Picture, which I'm not a fan of. So I'm glad least one director. Yeah, it's a rough movie, but you know how I feel about ocean films also.
You don't like ocean films?
It's a weird thing. Like pirates, they just usually don't work for me. Master and Commander, also not a favorite of mine.
This is funny.
I'm scared to revisit the Mutiny remakes. I haven't touched those yet, but I think from this list and the fact that I didn't recognize any of the movies you also listed there, I definitely think he deserved it. I may have even voted for Best Picture for this as well.
Yeah, I definitely would have. Speaking of, maybe that's your answer. If you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
You know, I think I will stick with Ford for director. I think Victor McLachlan is a close second, if not tied, because he has to carry this movie. He's the central character. It's his acting that allows us to feel that guilt. But I think Ford in reshaping a story that we have now seen before, I know this was 1935 at the time, but I think it's something that has stuck with, like you said, other directors. And I think a lot of movies nowadays are indebted to a story and a direction like this. So I would give it to him. What would your one Oscar be?
Not to match you exactly, but I would also give Ford Best Director for this. It's an incredible achievement that I think feels understated compared to the rest of his work, but really shouldn't, for all of the reasons that we discussed. His German expressionist influences, all the way to the performances he gets from his actors, the way he's experimenting visually, I think make this a great achievement in his career and a really strong Best Director win. I also love the Max Steiner score. I love Max Steiner's music from this period. So that would be my runner-up, I would say. Okay, on to our next film, The Grapes of Wrath from 1940. Description here, Tom Joad returns to his home after a jail sentence to find his family kicked out of their farm due to foreclosure. He catches up with them on his uncle's farm and joins them the next day as they head for California in a new life. This is, of course, based on the best-selling book by John Steinbeck and stars Henry Fonda, Jane Darwell, John Carradine, Shirley Mills, and more. This won two Oscars, director for Ford and best supporting actress for Jane Darwell. It received five other nominations, picture, actor for Fonda, screenplay, film editing, and sound recording. What did you think of The Grapes of Wrath?
So I had never seen this before. I really wanted to read the book first, which I have, but I also didn't read it in school. And I think a lot of people will be familiar with this because they watched it in high school and had to read the book. And maybe they see this as maybe a more annoying watch or memory for that reason. But I think John Ford, there's no one more qualified to direct this movie than him. It has similar themes from The Informer, and I think just this really grand story of the empty promise of the American dream. Again, I thought of The Brutalist, and
we're just going to keep talking about The Brutalist until we can't anymore.
We need John Ford's The Brutalist.
Yes.
This may be the closest thing we have to that, because we also have some beautifully crafted characters and great acting performances. We have wins and nominations for that, which thankfully align a naturalistic setting that he is really adept to showing us. And again, kind of like Wyler, you know, you have beautiful backdrops and other extras and people along the way that we meet that really round out this very bleak experience, and just one that keeps getting more and more depressing the further they get west. I like this film. There's not a reason to dislike it. It's a difficult watch for many reasons, but I think it's an important one that really shows you the American experience. And along with that, how capitalism with businesses and corporations kind of took over these families who were happy and changed their existence and pushed them out of their land. There's a great line about that we can talk about in a bit. So I think for the novel, you know, one that is very highly regarded by Steinbeck, and maybe you can speak to that and, you know, what it shows or doesn't show, differences there. But I think it's a movie that shows all of those difficulties and complexities of this experience really, really well, and balances the hope and the despair of that. What's your relationship with this? Had you watched and or read it before?
I am counting this watch as a first time watch because I watched this in high school over multiple classes after reading the book. And I feel like that just doesn't really do the movie justice. I loved this. I was pretty blown away by it and how it made me feel, because I think what's so interesting about the book is that, you know, it's so dark and controversial and very, very political, especially for the time. And a lot of people at the time thought that it was going to encourage strikes and this communal uprising because of how Steinbeck gets into the politics. And Ford gets into the politics. But I think what makes this such an incredible adaptation is how it turns those themes in the book into a story about a family. And he really focuses on the Jodes and what they're going through together, how they feel moment to moment. And we have these very intimate conversations, I think, especially between Tom and Ma, that I think are really beautiful in how they're shot and how those character faces are captured. I think this feels like such a human story in a way that Steinbeck's book does too. But this, I think, is just a pretty brilliant adaptation of it. And I think I was thinking a lot about how small it feels and how much I like that, because when you think of Ford, you think of these like westerns and the sweeping vistas and how beautiful land is. And here, like you said, we have these painted backdrops. It's not sweeping. It's much more human and small scale. And it feels like you were just watching these people go through it. And there is a lot of power in that, I think, especially because I was thinking a lot about contemporary films that talk about large-scale crime, like financial crime on communities. They always focus on the criminals or feel the need to glamorize that. Like, I was thinking about Adam McKay's films, for instance. Like, that is the anti-John Ford. That's the anti-Grapes of Wrath. And those films don't work for me because none of the characters feel like humans. Everything exists to communicate a specific message that is ultimately the director pontificating. And Ford is not doing that here. He's showing you all of those issues, yes, but by focusing on the Jodes, by focusing on this family, you get incredible performances from your actors that in turn makes you understand the gravity of the issue in a really unexpected, powerful way. So I loved this. I think there are so many things you can pull out of it that make it stand the test of time and just feel like an intimate epic, I think.
Yeah, it shows these really small moments between this family with this large scale idea and history of an entire people. And his camera here, I love that we get to see different techniques from him and ones that he's known for, especially like his doorways of people leaving through them. And then his camera, which you kind of alluded to, is mostly static. There's not a ton of movement. And I think that allows us to see the characters in a different way. It's not highlighting anything for us. It's for us to experience things as they're happening. And that, I think, doesn't overheighten the experience or try to influence us, I think, too strongly one way or the other. It's very bleak and, again, hard to watch, but I think he's doing that with the story itself and the experiences that they go through.
Yeah. And I think about, you know, some of those individual scenes that work really well for me. There's a scene at the diner when they go in and ask for bread, and the waitress is giving them a really hard time, saying that first they just make sandwiches, can't they have a sandwich? Then saying that the loaf of bread is 15 cents. And there's so much pride in these characters that, you know, he says, well, just give me 10 cents worth of this 15 cent loaf. That's what I have. And in that moment, we see how the Joad family feels, but also you start to see that guilt come over the waitress for what she's done and how she's communicating with the family. Because then when the kids are looking at the candy, she says, oh, it's 2-for-1 penny candy, mm-hmm. when it's really a nickel. And it's just those scenes like that, that just, like you said, camera is static. It's almost like we're watching a play. Like, we're just watching this one scene, these characters interact. But it's this, like, very sad but moving moment where you're understanding who this family is and what they're going through, especially in comparison to the rest of the country. And as they're moving through these places, they just want and need a little bit. And the resistance that they come up against, I think that scene perfectly communicates that.
Yeah, and it's an almost silent scene. There's talking between the two groups of people, of the Joads and then the people in this diner. But everything besides that is all done with cutting. And you're just watching their faces and their eyes communicate. And that's something that Ford does really well, is he lets their faces speak for themselves. And so you can see from them looking to one another, they're saying like, oh, just give it to them, because they're struggling way more than we are. Like, shut up. Just give him the bread. Give him all of the bread. And then with the kids too, it's so heartbreaking to watch. One of my favorite scenes, the quote that I was mentioning, comes earlier before they're on their journey, but it's when this businessman comes in his really nice car,
yeah,
to their house. And he's like, you got to go. You're being kicked out. And they say, well, no, we're not going. There's no way. And he's like, well, don't blame me. I'm just the messenger. And they're like, okay, then who can we talk to? He's like, well, I'm working for the people who own the land. And they're like, okay, who's that? And he's like, well, they report to the bank. And it's like, okay, who can we talk to at the bank? And they're like, well, they report to people out east. It's just like that cycle of corruption,
mm-hmm.
and how they keep pushing it up the ladder, as if it's this like mythical person that doesn't really exist. And it's like, this has to have come from someone. And that's the frustrating thing that we can absolutely see today with like the 1% or banks being in there. You know, it's like all of these things hold true, and it's so frustrating to watch. And this is just an early instance of that happening. And so when they're pushed out, they're on this journey and people in their family keep dying. The grandparents die along the way, and how they deal with that is so disheartening. And in the end, there's a really great quote, maybe my favorite in the movie, but it's, government's got more interest in a dead man than a live one. And it's just, it's so true. It holds the entire movie in a line.
Yeah. It's you talking about the funerals and, you know, when the grandparents die and how they all process death. It's one of the, I mean, it's such a sad detail in the movie, but the way that Ford captures that, he's a very tactile filmmaker. So when he shows Ma looking at these objects, or when he shows the letter that Tom has written when his grandfather dies. It makes those emotions, I think, hit home even more deeply. And like you said, too, about the scene with the man in the car coming up, there's another great moment later in the film where this rich guy in a shiny car, again, the way that Ford blocks this scene, too, he uses a lot of low angle shots to make, I think, the wealthier people or the government or the police feel even more menacing and threatening to the poor who are stuck at these camps. But that guy, he comes up, this rich guy, and he's promising more work for these people. And one man is very dubious of him, says, you know, like, where is your contract? I'm not doing this unless it is, you know, just questioning. And by questioning, he gets in trouble and is seen as, you know, a threat. And it made me think a lot about how specifically in today's politics, the Republican Party in particular and Trump are trying to convince people who are in dire economic situations that they have their best interests at heart when it is just not true. It's the complete opposite. But seeing that man just roll up and promise in this shiny car, you know, I have something for you, but he really doesn't. It just makes you realize how these themes are still prevalent today. And this was a contemporary piece at the time in 1940. And to think that we're 80 years from that and people are still experiencing that. I was thinking especially of, there's a scene that reminded me a lot of how people talk about immigrants and people coming in across the border. Made me think a lot about that as I was watching it and just thinking, yeah, not much has changed.
Yeah. That scene you're talking about, you know, when the businessman is like, oh, this guy's giving me trouble. He says it to the cop in his car that he brought to the camp. So that collusion too just drives me crazy, is that there's no way around this because they're working for them. They're getting paid by the businessmen to help them out and make sure that they can pay these workers as little as possible to keep this going, to save them money, to make them more money. You know, it's absolutely something we see today. And when Casey understands all of this, he becomes the next troublemaker that they target, because he's like, well, they're going to pay you 5 cents a box, but the next people, they're going to pay 2.5 cents. They're going to pay you half that. And he was right. So it's just this cycle that is just so disturbing. And going back to the death really quick, the second death, the grandma, is when they finally get to California and they see this shiny green horizon. They're like, oh my God, we made it. The green pastures and the flowers they talk about, this promise of California, it's real. And then Ma goes, grandma died in the car. She didn't want anyone to know. And it's just like, it brings it all back. And it's just so heartbreaking.
And we'll talk about some of the performances, I think, later as we get to some of our Oscar questions. But I mean, I will not be able to say enough nice things about Fonda. But Jane Darwell, I think, is pretty brilliant in this movie and just the heart of the film. These scenes, I think, on the surface of her and her co-stars, these other characters, are so simple. Yet she brings something so lived in and real to those moments where I just, in any scene that she's in, it is like you are, and again, we say this all the time, and I know it's cliche, but you feel like you were actually watching this woman go through it alongside her family. And I think she's also strong, like really strong in her moments alone on screen, where you're just watching her face in what's sometimes a wordless performance. I think it's one of the great Oscar-winning roles in performances.
Yeah, I agree. I'll talk about her in a little bit too. So I think let's get into our questions. How do you think today's Academy would receive this movie?
I think they would receive it very well. We're going to bring up The Brutalist again. It's funny because this isn't specifically an immigrant story, but it is a story of transition and of being forced out of a place and having to find a new one and having to find work. And Ford thought of his parents with this story and them leaving Ireland during the potato famine. So I think that is a really universal idea and experience that I think a lot of people, either through their parents or grandparents or even just in current politics, I think would connect with. It's also a major literary adaptation, and major literary adaptations tend to do well with the Academy. So I think it would still do really well today.
This is just immediate Oscars. I'm surprised we haven't heard of something in the works for a movie like this. I know Scorsese might be like an easy person to elect to direct something like this, but I think there are a lot of themes with Killers of the Flower Moon that he would get across so well with The Grapes of Wrath. And immediate screenplay win, definite acting nominations at least, you know, picture director. It just seems so simple. So yeah, I think they would love it. They would cherish it. I think it would do well at the box office. You know, it's just one of those universal stories that we will continue to hear time and time again, and that everybody can relate to.
And would you have given Ford Best Director? The competition's a little bit stronger here, I would say. We also had Sam Wood for Kitty Foyle, William Wyler for The Letter, George Cukor for The Philadelphia Story, and Alfred Hitchcock for Rebecca.
The one that I'm missing that would make this very, very hard would be Charlie Chaplin for The Great Dictator. This is so difficult. I mean, our picture winner this year is Rebecca. I think that's a great nomination in director as well. It's not a bad win. I'm just trying to think of who I would have given it to more. If I could tie with him and Chaplin, I think I would. I think just for the time, you know, this is after the Great Depression, but Chaplin's movie is coming during World War II, which is also great timing, and it's foreshadowing what's to happen. So I think I'm leaning with him, but this is obviously a great win by Ford too. Who would you give Best Director?
I'd give it to Hitchcock for Rebecca. I think that this was his best shot at winning Best Director because Rebecca won Best Picture. So I would give it to him here. I think that Ford's win is a great one. I think it's a really nice split having Rebecca and Grapes of Wrath in picture and director, but I would give it to Hitchcock. It's his, you know, his first American production. And I know there's a lot there about, you know, whose movie is it? David O. Selznick, Hitchcock. He had all sorts of fights on the set, but I think his interpretation of the Gothic tale really is what shines through and what makes it one of my favorite movies of all time. So I have to give the edge to Hitchcock, but I do love the Charlie Chaplin mention. I would have kicked out Sam Wood for Kitty Foyle and put Chaplin right in.
Mm-hmm.
But I would still give it, even if Chaplin is in, I would still give it to Hitchcock.
And then if you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
This is my time to say that one of the great Oscar travesties is Henry Fonda not winning Best Actor for The Grapes of Wrath. I love Jimmy Stewart so much. I think that we could give him a few other Oscars. I even love him in The Philadelphia Story. I love that movie. But what Henry Fonda does in The Grapes of Wrath, I was in awe of it. It's the type of performance that I always gravitate towards. I think that what he does here, he's just such a powerful movie star presence in the movie that you completely understand Tom, I think, in all of his stubbornness. I think you understand his more moody, brooding qualities too. And he's a great screen partner for Darwell and for all of our other actors. He's the perfect leading man here. And I feel like what's so brilliant about the performance is you, I think, just believe all of his struggles, his desperation, and his desire to move forward. And his last scene in the movie with Darwell just makes me cry. It really moved me just watching him in that moment where she really wants him to stay. And he's the one who really delivers the final message of the movie, that he's going to go out there and help the cause, help all of these families. And I think it's just a really beautiful, emotionally affecting moment. And I wish that he would have won this. I think Jimmy Stewart would have won one later if he didn't win here. I really do. And I think what Fonda does, it's probably, I think it's up there now, I can say, with like Pacino and others of favorite male performances to not win, but to be nominated. So I would go Fonda.
I do think he's great. I'm going with the other actor that won. So I will be giving mine to Jane Darwell, who I think is phenomenal. She's a great supporting actress winner. She's a face that we know from many other films. She has over 200 films to her
Mary
name.
Mary Poppins. Mm-hmm. That's always what I think of her in.
That's her last role. She was also in Gone with the Wind. In these 2 years, 1939 and 1940, she has 14 movies come out.
Well,
which is just insane.
Working actress.
She's great. Yeah. And I think what she does in this movie, you mentioned this before, is just in scenes with her, whether she's alone or with the family, she gets everything across so simply. And there's not much ado about it. It feels real, but it's devastating. It's her caring about the family, but also trying to help everyone else around her as well. There's the scene when they make it to the second camp and they're cooking food by the fire and all these kids come around her and they're like, "Do you have any food?" And she's like, "Well, I barely have enough for the family," but she's like, "Okay, go find a flat stick and I'll give you some." And so she's always trying to help everybody out. I think that's, in a motherly role, something that many people can connect to or at least appreciate. And I think in that final scene, hearing her say, "Well, Tommy, ain't you going to tell me goodbye?" Absolutely. I was just on the floor because, you know, he has to go. He has to save himself. And he's done everything right up to this point and just can't seem to get it right. But it's her saying goodbye and knowing that she's going to be left really supporting everyone else and hoping that one day she can be reunited with him. And that is just so sad. But I think it's the perfect note to end this movie on. You know, there's hope in the end with her final monologue. "We'll go on forever, Pa, because we're the people." I think that's probably some of why he won this award, is because of that in the end, and maybe for her, but she has so many good moments throughout this entire movie, not just one.
Yeah, I love that. She would be my second place. That's the thing. It's like, you could give this movie a lot of Oscars. I also want to mention one that wasn't nominated, Greg Toland, our DP, who shot Citizen Kane. Oh, this movie's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. It's so dark and there's so many shadows lit by candles, a lot like we talked about that with Barry Lyndon a long time ago, what I love about that film and the lighting. But yeah, characters will be so, it'll be so dimly lit or they'll be in shadow, and it just works so well, I think. So it's one of the most beautiful movies. So it's a shame he's not nominated. He would also be on my list of potential winners.
I will say for Fonda, my favorite line reading is early in the movie when he's getting off the car hitchhiking. He goes, "Homicide."
Yeah.
Telling the guy that that's what he got out of jail for. And the guy's like, "Oh my God, I gotta go."
It's wild. He and Jane Fonda have the same face.
Oh, yeah.
She looks so much like him in this movie, I think.
Okay, on to our final movie today, The Quiet Man from 1952. Description here: an American man returns to the village of his birth in Ireland, where he finds love and conflict. This stars John Wayne, finally a John Ford, John Wayne movie we can talk about, Maureen O'Hara, Barry Fitzgerald, Victor McLachlan again, and more. This won 2 Oscars for director and cinematography color, and had 5 other nominations for picture, supporting actor for McLachlan, art direction, set decoration, color, sound recording, and writing screenplay. What did you think about this movie? And this is the only one that we have that we've talked about today, and from How Green Is My Valley, that was in color, in Technicolor.
Well, it's good that you mentioned color, because Maureen O'Hara was known at the time as the queen of Technicolor. And I think that with that bright red hair, that really stands out here. And I'm glad that we get to talk about one of Maureen O'Hara's collaborations with John Wayne. They were known, I think, at the time as a major on-screen pairing. I believe they were in 5 movies together. So they were a very popular on-screen couple at the time. And he and John Ford are one of movie history's great collaborations. They're really like, you know, if you think of like Scorsese and De Niro or Hitchcock and Jimmy Stewart or Cary Grant, like there are some great on-screen collaborations from the time. But Ford really helped John Wayne become the movie star that he became. And this movie is interesting. And part of the reason why I like it is because we're seeing a different side of John Wayne than we do sometimes in the Westerns, where he's this very masculine, like macho hero type. And here he's a bit more subdued. And that's the funny thing with the title, is that he's really the quiet man coming into this environment where everyone is very loud and brash and boisterous. And I think it's a really beautiful movie. I think in terms of, you know, how it looks, it's this stunning Technicolor achievement, lots of blues and greens, and it's this very romanticized, idealized version of Ireland. I think, yes, there are a lot of stereotypes of Irish people in it, but it is this very romanticized version. And it's Ford thinking back to, again, his past, but thinking of an American going to Ireland. And I do just like that kind of folktale or fairy tale-like quality that the movie has. But overall, I think I enjoyed seeing Ford step into like a bit of a different wheelhouse compared to what we have seen with the other two movies, but still, I think, visit some of those themes that do come up in his earlier works, too. What did you think?
I had a more difficult time with this one. I think this is more aligned for you in multiple ways. One is that it's kind of a fantasy film in that it's like dreamlike. Like, is this really happening? The other, it's very much a romance film and centered on those two characters, the John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara relationship and how that develops. But I think the Technicolor is just out of this world. I could look at every frame of this movie and just be awed, kind of like Weird Connection, Mike Leigh's film, Mr. Turner. Maybe some of Kubrick and Barry Lyndon too, but it's just gorgeous to look at. There are some fun sequences too, you know, like the fight later on at the end. It's this drawn out, nearly comical thing that I like to see from Ford. This definitely is a turn for him in terms of those genres that I mentioned, but this drawn out fight sequence, which Sean Thornton is a boxer, so we kind of get to see that come back from his past. And a lot more comedy than I think we've gotten in his other two films that we talked about.
I also think, like, I do love the, you might disagree, I don't know. I love the Maureen O'Hara performance and character of Mary Kate, because she, I think when she's first shown on screen, she's just really beautiful, almost like this Outlander type character with her bright red hair. But really, she's this very outspoken woman. I love that. She wants to be independent and really retain her own identity. And really, these men are getting in the way of that, specifically her very irritating brother. And I think, though, that what I like about it, too, is she's not depicted in a really negative way. I think this character, in the hands of another director or writer, could be depicted as very irritating or someone who is, I don't know, like really a shrew character, because I was thinking about Shakespeare here in The Taming of the Shrew. It does follow kind of similar plot points and story structure, but she doesn't fall into those stereotypes as a character. And I also think that she has really good chemistry with John Wayne. And she, as an actress, is able to go really head to head with John Wayne and hold her own. I think they're a really good pair together. And I don't know, I like the character and her performance in it, especially when we think of women at the time and who would be in her circumstances.
I didn't dislike her. I think it is in some of the portrayal. It's also just, I think, a character, or the reasons that she does things are not something a Western audience would understand as well, because she really cares about her dowry and her brother giving that over, be accepting of the man that she will be with. So I think it's a journey in understanding how steadfast she is in that and seeing her strength. I like that from the very beginning, you know, that she was outspoken or rowdy, or that people kind of stayed away from her for that. It was funny, you know, when John Wayne sees her for the first time, he goes, "Is that real?" But the romance, you know, it was fine for me going through that and eventually getting the money and him burning that, you know, as a sign of kind of goodwill, but also that like it didn't matter. He wanted her in the end, and just knowing that the brother would accept is that he is now accepting of her ideals and her purpose of this entire journey that we're going on throughout the film.
Yeah. And I'll just say one more thing that I loved about it, like you were talking about with the look of the film and how beautiful it is. I do love that fairy tale fantasy-like quality of Ireland that Ford chooses to show here, because I think it really connects with what Sean, the John Wayne character, envisions in Ireland, you know, when he gets off this train, when he thinks about the land of his ancestors, and what Ford must have thought of as well when he actually went to Ireland, being a first-generation American and then going to Ireland, how he must have felt. And I like that the lush green environment is a manifestation of that. It's a way to interpret that. I think it can have that almost fake looking quality, right? It doesn't need to be completely realistic. I think that's what makes the movie special, is that it does have this sheen to it. It's this stereotypical Ireland that an American would envision if they heard about it from their parents or grandparents, or if they wanted to, you know, create their own story about that, and specifically one that's a romantic comedy, that's the perfect environment for that. So I think that Ford really pushes it again when we think about the environments he creates in his movies here. He takes it a step up and realizes, okay, you know, in The Grapes of Wrath, in The Informer, I need something that's really small scale and gritty and dark and bleak. And here, that's not what this calls for. This calls for something completely different. So what am I going to do? I'm going to push it and take it to a place that feels like a golden age musical.
Yeah, and this coming 12 years after The Grapes of Wrath, him not having a nomination even in that period feels like such a long time. So it being completely different, I actually like. It's also a culmination of those others in a way. But how do you think today's Academy would receive this movie?
This is tricky because on the one hand, I think, you know, a great director doing something completely different, it would be embraced probably. It's like, you know, when PTA made Phantom Thread, like making some completely different thing, stepping out of the 70s, making this gothic, English, weird romantic comedy, that was embraced. We're doing some weird comparisons today, but it's fine. But I also wonder if it would feel too slight for the Academy in some ways. So I'm pretty mixed on it. I think actually that it wouldn't get, I don't think it would get 7 nominations, but I can see it getting some big ones and maybe some techs as well. Maybe it's more like John Ford's Barbie.
Oh my God. Even weirder. Well, I have an even weirder comparison for you, and one that I didn't even see. So I don't know if this
great.
Is right, but Wild Mountain Time.
Stop. No, 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 no. The John Patrick Shanley movie with Emily Blunt.
Absolutely.
Oh, wow. I forgot all about that movie. I can promise you The Quiet Man is better, but that's a very funny comparison.
You have this rom-com of sorts. It takes place in Ireland, you know. But that's kind of how I see this movie doing today. 7 nominations with 2 wins? I don't think so. Maybe a few texts like cinematography, maybe some acting. But yeah, I just don't see it today.
And would you have given Ford Best Director? Our other nominees here, we had Joseph L. Mankiewicz for 5 Fingers, Cecil B. DeMille for The Greatest Show on Earth, Fred Zinnemann for High Noon, and John Huston for Moulin Rouge. Have you seen The Greatest Show on Earth, or Best Picture winner? This is like bottom of the barrel for me, one of the worst to ever win.
This is probably in my lower like 10th of Best Picture winners. So like maybe I would give it to Zinnemann for High Noon. This is not really, I think, a Ford win that I feel very strongly about. I'll say Zinnemann for High Noon. So I guess I'll say no. What would you do?
I would definitely give it to Ford. I am not a huge High Noon person, but I really do like The Quiet Man. And I think that Ford's direction, it's an interesting angle for him. And I think that what he puts together with the performances and our technical components here, I really like. It's a movie that I could see myself revisiting again very soon. It's also a favorite of my grandparents. I was talking to my mom about this morning. So maybe I'll watch it with my mom when I'm home next.
The Greatest Show on Earth, another Fableman's inspiration.
Oh, I know. Isn't it funny when you think about that movie being the one that influenced Spielberg? Right.
Trains, Trains, and More Trains, also in The Quiet Man. So if you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
I would give this movie one of its wins, cinematography color. I think that the look of the movie is what makes it stand out. It does have that fantastical quality that I love and that beautiful depiction of Ireland and Maureen O'Hara in Technicolor. When you think back on this movie, you think of the color and you think of the look of it. So I would go cinematography color. What about you?
So would I. It's just stunning to watch. I think that's the part of it that I would recommend to people to watch for. It's seeing the Irish countryside and the scenery. It just makes everything pop. So yeah, I agree.
Okay, let's get into some of our listener questions. So we have one from Matthew Anderson about How Green Was My Valley, which we didn't cover, but I think it's good to answer this question. Why do people want to dunk on How Green Was My Valley's Best Picture win? We definitely talked about this more in that episode, so we can link it in the description. But I think it's mostly just because it beat Citizen Kane. It's just one of those cases throughout history where the film that stands the test of time and that people talk about historically as maybe the greatest film ever made ends up losing, which then creates a problem for the movie that beat it instead.
Yeah, and then Ford winning director over Welles, too, I think is maybe surprising considering, but yeah, I think that's the main reason too.
Yeah, that's a classic case of what would have been a good split too. Mm-hmm.
The next question comes from Chels. Would you nominate or give Ford the win for any of his non-nominated films?
I think with The Searchers, I definitely would have nominated him there considering how influential that film is and how it's definitely one of his best movies. And if we look at the nominees there, I think I would still give George Stevens the win for Giant, a movie that I do really love. But yeah, kick out Michael Anderson for Around the World in 80 Days. We also had William Wyler for Friendly Persuasion, King Vidor for War and Peace, Walter Lang for The King and I. There's no reason we can't make room for John Ford here for The Searchers. So that would be my big one I would put him in for.
And I would say The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which comes in 1962. This is the year of Lawrence of Arabia, David Lean again, but we have Frank Perry nominated for David and Lisa. We have some other good ones. We have Pietro Jeremy for Divorce Italian Style, Arthur Penn for The Miracle Worker, and Robert Mulligan for To Kill a Mockingbird. But I think replace him with Perry and get him in there. This film was only nominated for Best Costume Design, Black and White. And I think As a Western is another great installment for him, along with The Searchers, along with Stagecoach, which he was nominated for, but one that I really connected with, I guess, kind of like Spielberg. And the Jimmy Stewart performance is also incredible in that, which Chels, part two question, I think maybe he wouldn't do as well with, but I think is interesting to think of. She asked, which of his performers or characters would thrive on Survivor? What are the alliances? Who has the best social game? Who gets blindsided? Or who wins?
Okay, so I'm going to stick with characters from the movies we talked about today. But I think Ma from The Grapes of Wrath has an incredible social game.
Octavia Spencer.
Octavia Spencer, I know. But every time she's called Ma, I'm like, this is
Bunny.
Don't make me drink alone, Ma. No, it's okay. I think she's a great social game. She takes care of her tribe. People want to work with her. And they would feel really bad voting her out. So I think she has a really good social game and can make it really far. She would definitely sit out of the challenges. She'd be like a Sandra Diaz-Twine, but that's okay. I think that Tom Joad could also do very well on Survivor, but he's very like moody and secretive seeming, which I think would maybe rub people the wrong way and they'd want to vote him out. But he is also, I think he could make really good relationships. And people are always, you know, excited to see him, excited he's back. He did kill someone in real life, so I think he'd have no problem voting anyone out.
Disclaimer.
There are so many good ones. I also think Mary-Kate from The Quiet Man would be really good. I think she could really go far. I think so. I think she could make really good alliances with men and women. I think she would be like very good social strategic player. And then, I mean, who gets blindsided? Obviously, if we go back to The Informer, it's really unfortunate, you know, what happens to Jippo in that movie, but he's getting blindsided. He's going to go on a reward and drink too much and get sent home like Keith when he ate too much meat on that one reward. I don't know if you know about this, but yeah, that's what's totally happening to him.
I see that for him, or just him just being lied to by everybody, being in multiple alliances and them just saying like, he's got to go. This is like 2/3 into the season. Like they've done all the heavy lifting. He's helped. He's done his part. And they're like, okay, he's too strong. If he sticks around, he's going to beat us. So he's got to go. My main one also was Jane Darwell, who I think is immediately in a top three. I think she has the best chance of winning. She just, again, that Ma energy, taking care of everyone, maybe being towards the back and like physical challenges, but she's the reason everyone else is surviving. Maybe she even like starts the fire first and, you know, she can help in other ways than doing some of the brute force like Jippo.
Yeah, she's a provider. I think she would do really well. Our next question comes from Andrew Carden. Is Jane Darwell in The Grapes of Wrath one of the all-time greatest Best Supporting Actress winners?
I don't have a list of the supporting actress winners, but you can see from my Oscar that I gave her for the movie, I do think she gives at least a top third of nominees or like top 25. I'll have to go through and look, though. I'm sure you've seen more winners than I have. Do you have a ranking or... do you have her pretty high?
Yeah, I would say she's probably in my top 10. She's pretty high up. I mean, my favorite ones are Meryl Streep in Kramer versus Kramer. She's my all-time favorite. Her, Ruth Gordon in Rosemary's Baby, Cloris Leachman in Last Picture Show, Rita Moreno in West Side Story, Olympia Dukakis in Moonstruck, and then I'd probably say Jane Darwell in The Grapes of Wrath. So very high. Yeah. I think she's great. I think she belongs right up there in that top group. And for all the reasons we said earlier, I think just about those quieter moments in her performance, the conversations she's able to hold with Fonda as Ma, I think are really beautiful and the heart of the film.
And then our final question comes from Isabel. If these three films were remade today, which three female and male directors would you like to see at the helm? I know I mentioned Scorsese for Grapes of Wrath before, but yeah, I'm curious who you have for everything.
I love this question. So we can do The Informer first. I think let's go back and forth maybe. For The Informer, I thought first I want to go with an Irish director for my male option. So I didn't do Scorsese. I actually went with Martin McDonagh because I think he can really do that kind of like bleak Irish pain very well. And I think he might infuse it with some humor too. So it might be a different type of film than what we have here from Ford, but I think he could be a really good fit. And then for the female director, I didn't go with an Irish woman here. I actually went with a Scot, which might be sacrilegious, but I went with Lynn Ramsey, who did We Need to Talk About Kevin, You Were Never Really Here. I think she could get to the core of the darkness that we have in The Informer. And again, just kind of that like bleak, gritty style. I think she could do that really well. And she's so good at character studies too. So those would be my two for that one.
I like those. So for the male, I had Alfonso Cuarón. I was thinking mostly of his recent series, Disclaimer, with Cate Blanchett, which I wasn't very high on. I have some bones to pick with him on that. But I think the ideas there are very similar to The Informer and Gippo's circumstances and in revealing his history, his past, his thoughts, and how that comes about. So I think he could do that. Something along with the humor, like you were saying, I put in the Coens also as an option, or Alexander Payne, who I think these are all very different movies, obviously, but I think I would like to see their take on it. And then for the female, I had Jane Campion, who I think, you know, John Ford, he focuses on naturalism a lot, and she's done that very well throughout her career. But I think looking at The Power of the Dog and those relationships and characters and what they go through, but also the setting, really added to that film. And I think she could do that here in Dublin too.
She might come up for me in a minute. But I think it's interesting you have her on The Informer. But I think she does have a Ford-like quality to her films. I could see that for sure. Who do you have for The Grapes of Wrath?
So I mentioned Scorsese, but I also had PTA, thinking of There Will Be Blood a bit there. And then for the female, I had Chloe Zhao, who I think there are a lot of similarities to Nomadland and also The Rider, in a similar vein of Jane Campion. But I would love to see her take on a grander scale epic like this. Who do you have?
I like both of those. So when I was thinking about what makes Ford's version of The Grapes of Wrath really stand out, it was thinking about how he changed it and made it a really human story about the family. And I was thinking a lot of those close-ups. So I went with Barry Jenkins. I think he's so good at looking back at history and collective pain tied to politics and communicating that through the characters. So I went with him. For the female director, there are a couple of options. Jane Campion is one of my choices. I like Chloe Zhao as well. I think for all of the reasons you picked Campion for The Informer, I picture here because this is the film where we have those small, intimate, claustrophobic moments and also those expansive exteriors. And I feel like she would be really good at that. I also think Kelly Reichert would be really good at it. She was my other choice here. I love seeing her films that take place in that space outside. And I think, you know, when I think back to First Cow, or some of her other films, Meek's Cut Off, she's really comfortable also in the Western space or the neo-Western space. So I think she could use that here for The Grapes of Wrath and really access a new part of the book that we hadn't thought of before.
And then who do you have for The Quiet Man?
So for The Quiet Man, I was thinking a lot about the Technicolor, honestly, and some of the themes that come up. So for my male director, I went with Todd Haynes because I think he would feel very comfortable with this story in this space. I think he would actually really use it as a way to make his own version of a 50s film in the way that he did when we think about Far From Heaven. He's so comfortable in that space making a Cirque film. So I think it'd be interesting to see his take on a romantic comedy. I also am envisioning a young Julianne Moore in the Maureen O'Hara part as his favorite redhead. So I think that was where I went there. And then for the female director, I went with Greta Gerwig because we know after Barbie and Little Women how great she is at playing with color and thinking about that in her films to communicate where her characters are past and present and what they're going through. And also, she has a great sense of humor. And I think it would be good to infuse this film with some more progressive politics, maybe, for the Maureen O'Hara, the Mary Kay character. So I went with her here. I think she'd have a lot of fun with it.
I love those. My male director, again, thinking of the naturalism, many of these scenes are shot outdoors. So I immediately went to Terrence Malick. I think that could be beautiful. And then with the women, I put Kelly Reichert here, actually, I think for similar reasons that you said for The Grapes of Wrath. And then I also thought of Joanna Hogg when I was
my girls.
I was like, this is for you. Looking at readings of the film, there were some that saw it as a fantasy or like a dream. And when you look at Innisfree as this heaven-like place, I immediately thought of Joanna Hogg and her ghost-like stories, especially with The Eternal Daughter and Tilda Swinton there. So yeah, I think some great options all around.
Yeah, I love all of these directors that we talked about too. I think they would all be really good here. And that probably speaks to, I think, how we think about the movies as well. So that was a great question. And that was our episode on the films of John Ford, his best director wins. I had a lot of fun discussing these. I think it's always good to go back in time and think about film and Oscar history. I love when we do that.
I think initially we wanted to pair this with Kevin Costner and all of his saga films that haven't yet come to be. But I'm glad we did this too, talking about a master, especially one that the Oscars did award. So going back through some of his older films, I had a great time as well.
And next time on Oscar Wilde, we'll be going back in history a bit again. We will be in preparation for Wicked Part 1, celebrating the 85th anniversary of The Wizard of Oz, nominated for Best Picture, and a huge classic film and inspiration to so many filmmakers, to so many cinephiles out there. So I can't wait to talk about this one.
Yeah, I'm excited to cover this. That's a big anniversary and a big year at the Oscars. Thank you all for listening. Feel free to rate, review, and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at Oscar Wilde Pod. We have bonus content on our Patreon at patreon.com/OscarWilde. And you can check out our website for updated nomination predictions at oscarwilde.squarespace.com.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.